Okay, maybe we can start. So I was thinking about what to talk about tonight, and I think some of the kind of the obvious things like Buddhism and AGMs, for example, and Buddhism and committee meetings, that kind of stuff, it didn't sound quite right. So I thought I had to kind of cast the net a bit wider to see if I could think of something else. And one of the things that I think underlies so much of our human experience, and one of the things that's also very important from a Buddhist point of view, and that is the idea of views. Views is important because it is often the things that lead to problems in life. Yeah, we have views about this, views about that, whether it is political matters, spiritual matters, which sports team is better, yeah, that kind of stuff, really important things. It is important in a sense, isn't it? And all of these things, we have views about things. And of course, once you have a view, there's guaranteed somebody else is going to have the opposite view. And that's why we have problems. That's why we argue, even at the Buddhist Society sometimes, we have arguments, as you have seen, on committee meetings and these kind of things. They're usually quite friendly, but sometimes these things happen. But on the other hand, even though this is can be problematic, and we obviously need to learn how to live with these things, and this is one of the things I want to talk about, on the other hand, this whole sphere of views is also very important from a Buddhist point of view. Because in Buddhism, we have the idea of right view. Yeah, the idea of right view is like the foundation of the very Buddhist path, the very first thing that you come to when you come to the Noble Eightfold Path. If you don't know what the Noble Eightfold Path is, it is the path that leads out of suffering, that leads to awakening, leads to the highest kind of happiness. Yeah. The very first thing that whole path starts out with is right view. Yeah, so it is like the outlook, how we look at the world, what kind of relationship we have with the world is so important at the very foundation of the Buddhist practice. And right view is also found in kind of profound teachings like dependent origination. If you haven't heard that word before, you probably will soon, because this is kind of core Dhamma, things you hear about all the time if you hang around in Buddhist circles long enough, is part of that, yeah, very core part of Buddhism. And view is also the thing that you kind of get when you practice the path to the very end. Ultimately, it's called dittipatto. Dittipatto means attained to view. Why? Because you actually give rise internally to that view which aligns with the way the Buddha saw the world and the way the Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, actually is expounded. Yeah, so the whole path, in a sense, can be regarded as an adjustment of our view, adjusting the view in accordance with reality. And this is kind of the whole point here. You want to have a view that accords with reality, because if your view accords with reality, you can actually act in the right way. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. Yeah, if your view is not in accordance with reality, you're going to do all kind of silly things because you're kind of going the wrong way, hitting your head against the rafters, yeah, or whatever it is, because you think the rafters aren't there. Bang, wrong view. Wrong view always leads to suffering. Yeah, that's kind of the point there. Yeah. So view is a very important aspect of the whole Buddhist teaching. The Buddha had views. Yeah, the Buddha, that's why he taught. And he said, this is the way the world is. The Buddha is said to be the eye of the world. The eye of the world, because he saw things the way they truly are. And then he passes it on to those people who are interested in that. Views, very significant. So how do we deal with views? How do we come, first of all, even to the Buddhist path? How do we come to the very first aspect of right view that enables us to start out on the Buddhist practice? I want to just give one example of this. This is one example that occurred to me a while ago, and I thought it's actually quite interesting here. And it may seem a bit irreverent in some ways, and I apologize if it is a bit irreverent, but I like to be irreverent, so please excuse me for that. But it occurred to me, I was thinking, you know, so many religions, you have this idea of a creator God. Yeah, God creates the universe, and then everything kind of starts from that. But Buddhism doesn't have that. In Buddhism, we have the Buddha instead. And the Buddha is not a god. He's not a creator god. He's not kind of the almighty essence of the universe or anything like that. So it occurred to me, what is more, what is to be respected more? What is actually more to be revered and honored? Is it this creator god? Or is the Buddha? It may sound like a strange question, yeah, but what actually is more impressive in the world? Is this creator God more impressive? Or is the Buddha more impressive? Is there any way we can compare these two? And I thought about the idea of a creator God, and usually the way a creator God is depicted in most religions, he's usually he, she, it, whatever it is. We don't really know exactly what it is, so it's uncertain, but all-powerful, yeah, you have kind of full power. Usually you're also all-loving, so you have this kind of great metta and kindness for the whole world. But the problem is, for the creator God, is that they have always been like that. How much credit can we give that creator God for having those qualities if they've always been like that? Since time immemorial, since the beginning of time, they had those qualities, and eventually one day down the track, after an infinite amount of time, they decide to do something. And that one thing that the creator God does is to create the universe. Yeah, snaps his fingers, bang, the universe is in existence. But this creator God has always been all-powerful, from the very beginning, always been all-loving. How much credit, how much respect can we give that being for being like that, if they've always been like that? They haven't really done anything to deserve that, they just are like that. Yeah, this is kind of the creator God, and they create the universe. And then you may ask yourself, was that a good idea to create the universe? It's a good question, isn't it? I remember many of you have probably read the famous Douglas Adams, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And in there he says, in the beginning God created the universe, and many people were very angry. And many people thought that was a really bad move to create the universe. That's how he starts out, the Hitchhiker. Well, not start, I haven't actually read the book, but it's a very famous quote from that book. I think that's quite a Buddhist outlook in a sense. Yeah, maybe creating the universe. Yeah, there's a few flaws in this universe. Was it really such a wise thing to do to create the universe? That's the one thing he did. So here is this being that's perfect from the beginning. And then it does an act of creation, which is, to be honest, it is a bit flawed, this act of creation. That is why there is so much suffering in the world. Yeah, if some creator God really, I said I was going to be a bit irreverent. Please excuse me. So this is how I look at the creator God. This is just my view. Please have your own view about these things. But then comes the Buddha. Yeah. The Buddha starts out, and this is actually found in the discourses of the Buddha. You find this directly in the suttas. And how do the discourses describe the Buddha before his awakening, before he actually found the truth and all these kind of things? And the way he is described is very much like all of us, yeah? He had his defilements at that time. He had a wife and a child. Sometimes he would get upset about things. Sometimes he would have desires. Sometimes he would be confused. Yeah, this is directly written in those discourses. And the Buddha tells us about those things because he wants us to know, this is how I practice. This is how I overcame these things. This is how you should practice as well. Yeah, and then having... Not only that, but he had wrong view. He started out doing all the ascetic practices, not really understanding the path to awakening, what you're supposed to do to reach it. Yeah, he was confused as well, didn't know what the right path was. He was fumbling around in the dark. The Buddha didn't have any teacher, no one to lead him around. We have a teacher at the very least, his name, of course, being the Buddha. He had nobody. He was fumbling around in the dark. And then through his... own abilities, and this is one of the other abilities the Buddha had, he was also quite humble in a way. He started out not with a massive ego, say I'm going to find the path for myself. He started out looking at the teachers that were available in India at that time. These teachers were called, one was called Alara Kalama, other one called Udaka Ramaputta, and there were others as well. These are kind of ancient Indian names. Actually, still probably have them in India today. Nothing changes in India. Have you been to India? If you go to India, 2,500 years later, you read the suttas, you go to India now, still, there's lots of similarities. Yeah, India is one of these timeless realms. One of the things that makes it very charming and very nice. You go back, you go there now, still, you can kind of see the suttas, and the reality now is actually very similar in many ways. So you have these sages, and the Buddha goes to them. He learns what he can from these ancient meditation masters that were around at the time. And of course, it turns out that they are not able to take this exceptional spiritual person to the goal that he is looking for, which is the end of all suffering. So because he can't do that, at that point he decides, okay, I'm going to strike it out on my own and try to find the solution to this. And then he is able to do that. Here is a man who starts off as a human being, ordinary human being, just like us, and then takes the human status, the human situation, to its maximum potential. Is that worthy of respect or what? I think that is so worthy of respect. It's so worthy of honor. It's so worthy of, wow, this is just astonishing how anyone can do this. If you look at yourself and you know that we are, each one of us, I know myself, I'm certainly a very flawed person. Yeah, and I think it's just absolutely remarkable that there was even one person in history who was able to do this all by themselves. It is so worthy of something very special. And not only does he do that, but he does something far more than that. After he has found the truth, after he has kind of discovered the very meaning of life, the highest happiness you can have, the ending of all suffering, I think this is such an important thing to grasp, that actually what the Buddha has discovered is the answer to the question of the meaning of life. He discovered the meaning of life. That's what it is. When you have, if you look inside of yourself, you know, what are we all searching for? There's always this movement towards contentment, towards happiness, towards completion, away from suffering. Everything we do in life is based on that. And here is someone who found that, to the very core. So he has found the answer to the meaning of life. What are you going to do? And then he goes out and he teaches people. The next 45 years he spends just teaching people about the discovery that he has had. He says, listen, I found the meaning of life. I know you haven't seen it yet. I have seen it. This is what I found. 45 years. The Buddha would much rather just hang out, chill out, do meditation practice. When the Buddha meditates, it's really profound. It's even more profound than Ajahn Brahm. It's really, really profound. And the happiness he gets is just like, it's almost incomprehensible. If you come from an ordinary consciousness, it's almost incomprehensible the kind of stillness and happiness and peace that the Buddha is able to experience through his meditation practice. But you start, as you start out on your own path with your own meditation, you start to gather what this is all about. And it really is incredibly powerful. So instead of doing that, he does of course do some meditation, but he also sets out and uses his life to the service of others because he knows that he has found the answer to the very meaning of life itself. He sets out to support people, and then people, when they hear the message, they think, wow, this is it. This is the meaning of life. And this is one of the things that I think is a thing we should make a lot of when we teach the Buddhist teachings. That this is really what it is about, because it is a very, very powerful thing. Once you get your head around the Buddhist teachings, how they work, how they function, how they analyze the human experience, you actually start to see that this is probably true, because you analyze the human psychology, the human experience, in a very kind of deep and very profound and very realistic way. And I think a lot of us can actually relate to that. So this is what the Buddha does, So when I kind of compare the idea of a creator God, and I compare that to the Buddha, I think there is no comparison for me. There's no doubt where I want to put my respect, who I want to honor, the kind of qualities that I really think are especially worthy. The Buddha is this kind of such an outstanding example of what humanity can be, what each one of us can be. And I do apologize to anyone who feel that I'm being unfair. Maybe I'm being unfair. That is just my point of view on that. So this is one way that we gradually, just by thinking about the world, looking at the world through our own ways, trying to be wise about it, we start to kind of move towards something that from a Buddhist point of view would be called right view. But for many of you, you are already probably Buddhist or partially Buddhist or Buddhist, but don't really want to call yourself Buddhist. I know this is a very common thing in kind of a modern society. People say, I practice the five precepts, the Eightfold Path, I do meditation retreats, but I'm not really ready to call myself Buddhist yet. Even though you are a far better Buddhist than the vast majority of Buddhists around the world, you're doing much more Buddhist than anyone else does. So all those people actually call themselves Buddhist, still people are kind of afraid of being locked into a box. And that's fine. You don't have to kind of accept the label of Buddhist if you don't want to, but as far as I'm concerned, you're already doing all the right things from a Buddhist point of view. So if you are already on that path, how do we decide the things that are really Buddhist in the world? when we come across different views, we hear about different teachings, yeah, maybe even you read the word of the Buddha a little bit, and maybe you can't really understand it, you wonder what is important, what isn't, and you hear two different monks, they tell you, one monk tells you X, the other monk tells you negative X, the exact opposite. So which one are you going to believe, X or negative X? It's problematic, yeah. So how do we decide? This again is about views in the world, views that are presented to us. How do we actually deal with this? And I'm not saying this kind of idly, because it is just the idle question. This is actually very realistic. These things happen all the time. And not so long ago, we had some monks who came through Perth, and they had this radical new Dhamma teaching, yeah? Which, from their point of view, actually was, this is it. This is the real teaching of the Buddha. Forget everything else now. We are kind of come back to the source. And I just wanted to discuss that very briefly, how can we decide in a situation like that, what is real, what is not real. It's very hard for all of you. I know how difficult it is. Sometimes it's hard for me. I'm supposed to be the professional, right? Monk, yeah, professional, do this full time. Still sometimes I find it hard to, you know, kind of filter through. Actually, these days I'm pretty kind of clear about what I believe in and what I don't believe in, but it took a long time to gain that clarity here. Far more difficult if you are kind of like you guys, semi-professional, yeah, or just a little, or maybe just amateur even, yeah, you're kind of struggling a little bit on this path. So because of that, how do we do this? And one of the things that became very clear about this teaching that these monks taught that came through Perth was that it was a radical reinterpretation of some of the very most fundamental terms and idea and concepts that we have in Buddhism. And the term that they wanted to redefine was the word anatta in Pali. Anatta in Pali means non-self. Yeah, non-self is one of these core things that you can actually realize as you practice this path. And they were arguing that from the time these teachings were received into the Theravada tradition, it had been misunderstood. Actually, it doesn't mean non-self. It means futile. So you can choose between futile and non-self, yeah? And it's quite different, isn't it? Futile and non-self. Actually, futile also can be, it has many Buddhist aspects to it, so it kind of sounds maybe that it could be something to it, yeah? It could maybe be part of the teaching in the broader sense. But for that particular word, it is a massive difference to talk about either non-self or futile. Really, really massive difference. And if we take non-self out of Buddhism, it's a little bit like taking the wheels off a bicycle, yeah? A bicycle without wheels is not quite the same thing anymore. Would you agree? How useful is your bicycle to you without wheels? It's kind of lost some of its purpose. It's not kind of, not really all that useful. So, in the same thing, take anatta out of Buddhism, you have radically transformed it to a bicycle without wheels. Bad news, yeah, really, really bad news. I don't use a bicycle, but I'm guessing that is bad news. It looks like bad news when you see it on the street, a bicycle without wheels. So what do we do then when we are given these things? And of course, they will have done their homework. They will have good reasons for why this is the case, yeah, why there is such a difference. So what do we do? How do we decide? One of the things that is very obvious in a case like this is to remember that we have, 2,500 years of Buddhist tradition, and all scholars, yeah, all monastics, all academics who have studied this agree that the meaning of this word is non-self. And here comes this self-proclaimed kind of brilliant master who says, no, it isn't that, it actually is something else. So the weight of evidence is just kind of massively on one side, and it's very, very small evidence on the other side. And that is already a very good reason to be skeptical. Otherwise, it's almost like they're claiming to be the Buddha, because they have kind of seen something that nobody has seen in the entire history of Buddhism. Yeah, at least from the time of the beginning of Theravada Buddhism. But actually, it is worse than that. It is much worse than that, because if you look at the other schools of Buddhism, apart from the Theravada, and what is interesting in Buddhist history is that these schools started to emerge from each other and separate from each other about 200 years after the Buddha or thereabouts, before there was any Theravada Buddhism, before there is the Buddhism that we have now. And all those other schools of Buddhism, they too have non-self, yeah? You go to the suttas that have been preserved in Chinese, in ancient Chinese, non-self. You go to those that have been preserved in Tibetan language, non-self. You go to those that have been preserved in other languages, Indian, ancient Indian languages, Sanskrit, Gandhari, other Prakrits. These are the ancient languages of India, or even modern, some of them. Yeah, all non-self. And that is where you kind of start to understand there is a problem here with this interpretation. It goes against everything else that we know. And that is a very, very good reason to be skeptical. So this is how you kind of guide yourself, yeah? And you have some idea how to find out the real teachings and kind of get to the core of what this is all about. And more generally, if you read about Buddhism and you maybe even dare to go to the suttas, to the discourses of the Buddha himself, and I would really recommend you to do that, because the suttas are really beautiful, sometimes very powerful. Read something like the Dhammapada. You know the Dhammapada? The little book with verse. Yeah, Dhammapada, one of the favorite books of Buddhism. If there's one book you may want to buy, get that one. It has about 350 verses in it. And every night before you go to bed, just read one verse. Yeah, and then, oh, I feel so happy now. Oh, I go to sleep. Sleep so well. Wake up in the morning, energized. Yeah? Sometimes that's all you have to do. If it's a really good verse, if it's something that really touches you, it actually has this kind of effect on you. Like, there's a very beautiful verse which says something like, you know, hatred never ceases through hatred in this world. Hatred only ends through love. This is an eternal law. Yeah, and when you think about that, the Buddha said this 2,500 years ago, you think, yes, this is exactly right. This is just so spot on. And you know that that wisdom that the Buddha had is also your wisdom because you understand what he's talking about. And then off you go to bed and you sleep really nicely afterwards. That's the theory anyway, so see how it works. And so try, when you start reading those suttas, initially when you start out, it may be quite, you may feel it a bit onerous to read them. You wonder, you know, how it all fits together, how it all hangs together. And one of the basic principles of reading the word of the Buddha is to take as most important those teachings that occur again and again and again, that the Buddha gave in different contexts, that he gave to different people in different situations, yeah, with slightly different wordings, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Four Divine Abidings, yeah, Metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, upeka, equanimity. All of these beautiful things that the Buddha talked about. Again, the gradual training, the whole training from you start out coming to Dhammaloka the first time. Yeah, it doesn't say Dhammaloka in the suttas, yeah, but you can kind of read that into the suttas because it kind of implied. First time you come to Dhammaloka, kind of that's the entry point, yeah, and at the other end you come out of the tunnel, arahant, fully awakened being, yeah. So that gives you that gradual training here, starting with Dhammaloka, ending with arahant. You know the word arahant? Arahant means fully awakened, yeah, fully awakened being here. So if you like to be awakened, I really recommend it, yeah, it's a good idea to be awakened. It means that you see things according to reality, and when you see the truth, normally you tend to be happy as a consequence. Awakening is recommended by the Buddha, so this is how you do it. So don't be afraid of awakening. So this is how you then find and how you kind of sort out your right view on this path. And this is how we deal with, if you like, the external aspect of right view, the right view as it comes from the outside, how we filter through the mass of various propositions and ideas that come to us and then gradually move in the right way. But there's also, of course, our own views, the views that we have already. How do we deal with that? How can we be skillful about our own views of the world so that we can live in harmony with people? We don't have to argue all the time. Yeah, I'm a Buddhist. I'm going to teach you about Buddhism because Buddhism is the best. Yeah, forget about whatever religion you have because Buddhism is much better. I've been there. I've done that. I went to my parents and said, listen, mom and dad, this is the way. And of course, what happens? They turn away. They don't want to have anything to do with it. That's the wrong way of approaching anyone, especially your parents. There's no way they're going to listen to you. So don't, please don't make that mistake. So instead, we start to understand the nature of our views. And once you understand your nature of your views, you start to become far more humble about your views. So one of the things about our views is that we attach to our views. And you, I'm sure you already know that already. It's blooming obvious that we attach to our views, yeah? Because whenever somebody challenges you, you become defensive, you want to argue about them. Why? Because you are attached to them. That's exactly why we argue about them. Because they are dear to you. They are part of your personality. They are part of your identity, part of you, who you are. So when somebody challenges your views, they're actually challenging your very identity. Why is that? And the reason that is so is because it all comes from the sense of self. Yeah, this is one of those profound teachings of the Buddha, and the idea that we all have a sense of self, and I'm sure you can all relate to that pretty much straight away. We have a sense of self. But what does it mean to have a sense of self? It means that there are certain parts of you, certain attributes of you that you imbue with that sense of self is imbued with. Yeah, the sense of self has to have an existence. It has to be something. So certain parts of you that you take, this is the sense of self. This is who I am. Yeah, I am the experiencer. I am the knower. I'm the one who is aware. I am the doer in the world. Yeah, to be is to do. Yeah, one of these famous philosophers apparently said something like, to be is to do. You express your existence through your actions. That's basically what it means. And when you act, you feel alive, quite literally, because you are expressing that sense of self, which is already inside of you. So, because of that, because we have the sense of self inside of us, we attach to certain aspects of the world, to certain aspects of our experience, because that is what we take to be ourself. And also, because we have a sense of self, we also have views about that sense of self. And the world, according to the Buddha, there's two primary views in the world. And those two primary views are called the views of eternalism and the view of annihilationism. I can barely say that. Annihilationism. Yeah, and it's... How come these two views are the kind of the most common views in the world? Well, it's very obvious. If you exist... If you have a sense of self, I am, and you are happy with that I, yeah, you feel good about yourself and all these kind of things, you want that to continue. Not only do you want it to continue, but because you feel that you actually exist, you expect it to continue even after you pass away. And the idea of an internal self, a sense of I, that continues in identical form after you pass away, that is called eternalism in Buddhism. There's an internal self which just carries on. And if you look at the vast majority of religions in the world, they are eternalist religions. Even some philosophers, they have eternalist philosophies based around the same that principle. And where does it come from? It comes from the sense of self. It's a projection of the sense of self onto the world outside us. This thing carries on forever after. But then there is the other view. The other view is what we call annihilationism in Buddhism. And this is the feeling that actually, yeah, I feel like I exist, but actually existence is such a pain. Yeah, I don't really want to exist. My life, and I've heard people who have been like this, is a bit sad in a sense, but there are people like that who, when you tell them that, well, maybe you will get reborn, they say, oh no, I don't want to get reborn. That's the last thing I want. I just want to be annihilated and kind of, you know, be forgotten about forever after. That's what I really want. And people are like that. And this is where that view of annihilationism actually comes from. It comes from this idea that, well, actually, when I die, yeah, life isn't really worthwhile anyway. And so you project that idea onto reality, and then annihilationism comes from that. It also comes from rational thinking, yeah? Rational thinking says, yeah, why should there be anything after death? So you're annihilated. And that these things kind of come together. Yeah? And of course, that is very much the modern kind of view, yeah? The kind of atheist view that when you die, everything is gone. And there's a lot to be said for that view. I have a lot of sympathy for that view in so many ways. And then comes the Buddha comes along and he says, all of these views, actually, they're all wrong, yeah? And this is kind of what is interesting about Buddhism. Sometimes it's so radical. It is so completely different from any kind of anything else in this world. And it finds what the Buddha calls the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. How can there be a middle way between eternalism and annihilationism, you may ask? How is that possible? And this is what in Buddhism is called dependent origination. It is a middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. And there is a beautiful sutta. I'm going to quote the suttas. I love to quote the suttas. It's a very profound sutta called the Kacchamagotta Sutta, found in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, where the Buddha says that the reason why the annihilationist view arises in the world, yeah, is because people don't understand the origination of the world. The reason why the eternalist view arises in the world is because people don't understand the cessation of the world. But for the one who understands the cessation of the world as it actually is, the one who understands the origination of the world as it actually is, both the annihilationist and the eternalist views disappear. Why is this? And to understand what the Buddha is getting at here, you have to understand that by the world, the Buddha means the world of experience. What is your world? Your world is the experience you're having now, or the experience you're having throughout the day or throughout the years. The world of experience. Whatever comes in through the senses, things, sounds, feelings, all of these kind of things. That's the world of experience. It's either painful or pleasant or whatever it is. So this is what is meant by the world. Now that world of experience, what does it originate through? It originates through craving. As long as there is craving there, that world of experience will keep on perpetuating itself into the future. That's why when you die, that cycle cannot stop. It cannot stop because craving is then projecting it into the future, perpetuating it on into a future life. So this is why the origin of the world, that's why annihilationism is wrong. But at the same time, if you end that craving, if craving comes to an end, what happens then? If craving comes to an end, then the fuel, the thing that drives rebirth, that drives renewed existence, has come to an end. And for that reason, eternalism is wrong. It cannot actually perpetuate itself anymore into the future. That is what dependent origination is all about. I'm not going to say anything more about it. It's actually very beautiful and quite profound. And if you didn't understand a word of what I was saying, that's fine. As you keep on practicing on this path, you will get around to these things as well. It's very beautiful and very powerful. And it all comes from inside into the nature of reality. Right view, right understanding of what this life is all about, what this existence is all about. That is why the Buddha says, we try not to attach too much to our views, but we don't actually have much choice. Some attachment is always required. Some attachment is necessary because it is an extension of our sense of self. As long as you have a sense of self, these views are inevitable. So don't worry too much about your views. It's okay to have views. Don't think I should have no attachments. Don't think I should have no views, because it is inevitable that you have that. Instead, you start on the path and you start to understand what Buddhism is all about. And as you do that, your views gradually become aligned with reality, the way things are according to Buddhism. So this is one of the ways of thinking about these things, that we have attachment to views, and it's okay. But once you start to see that, you also start to become a little bit more humble about it. Another thing that makes you even more humble is to understand how the views actually come into existence in the first place. What is it that gives rise to our views? Very often we think that it is my rational thinking, I think about these things very rational, and because I think about it very rationally, I take the rational view. This is how we like to think of ourselves, as rational beings who have the right outlook, because we have really good reasons for looking at things in this way. But you wonder, if it is so rational, how come that our views are so diverse in the world? If it really was all about rationality, then in the end maybe we would all be aligned, have the same view. We would all be Buddhists, or maybe we would all be Christians, or maybe all atheists, or we would all vote for the Liberal Party, or maybe we would all vote for the Greens or whatever, because there's only one truth. It just isn't like that. So how do these views actually come into existence? And the way these views come into existence is that they are conditioned into us. Yeah, you start off as a child. As a child, your parents have certain views, certain ways of looking at the world. Your parents have certain ways and things of looking at the world. The environment around you, the people that you meet, what you read, all this information comes into you. Yeah, and this is how you are conditioned into looking at the world in a certain way. From a Buddhist point of view, it is even more profound than that. Because from a Buddhist point of view, a lot of that conditioning also happens in past lives. So it's literally something that is written into your DNA from a long, long, long time ago. Yeah, and the views you have now are, in a sense, the sum total, yeah, of all that conditioning. And sometimes people ask me, why are you a Buddhist? Yeah, for blooming sake, you were born in Norway. Yeah, cold country, snow and ice, yeah. Everybody is an atheist. Actually, not everybody is an atheist. A lot of some Christians, some atheists, more and more Muslims as well in Norway these days, yeah. No Buddhists in Norway. Well, at least not when I grew up. Yeah, I didn't know any Buddhists. My parents weren't Buddhist. It was kind of, why on earth are you a Buddhist monk? How many Norwegian Buddhist monks are there anyway? There's two in our monastery down here. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. We have two Norwegian monks down in our monastery in Serpentine. That's pretty, whoa. And there's a couple in Thailand and you know, a few like that. Very, very few Norwegian Buddhist monks around the world. Why am I a Buddhist monk? And I feel really sheepish when I have to tell them the truth. I'd like to say, I read the Tripitaka, yeah, it all makes perfect sense. I knew I had to be a Buddhist. But actually, that truth, the unfortunate truth, I think, I probably was a Buddhist monk in a past life, yeah? So it's a habit. I'm just playing out a habit pattern, doing the same thing in this life as I did in the past life. It's a bit, almost embarrassing to have to admit that, isn't it? It's almost like, can't I think for myself? And that's the point. You can't think for yourself. That's the whole point, yeah? You are brainwashed. You have come. All you can really do in this life is choose your brainwashing. So if you're going to choose the brainwashing, choose the good one. Remember, there's a double meaning with brainwashing here in Buddhism. It means that you come here, we teach you the Dhamma, and then you say, yes, sir, look, 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 and you follow along, yes? That's the number one brainwashing here. But there's another aspect to this brainwashing, and that is the fact that you actually get your mind cleaned out. Yeah, all the defilements, duk, 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 to one side, and you get this nice, shiny brain and mind on the other side. This is what meditation is about. You sit down, you glow in meditation, and that is the mind that has been purified and has been brainwashed through reading the discourses of the Buddha, coming to the Dhammaloka Center, and allowing yourself this beautiful brainwashing. Remember, you have to be brainwashed anyway. Conditioning by its very nature is brainwashing. You have no choice. All you can really do is kind of try to guide yourself towards the right brainwashing. Yeah, that's really all you can do. So how does this come about? Okay, so you have all these opinions and views about things, yeah? You've been a Buddhist monk in the past life, okay? So you come into this life and you feel this draw. It's almost like you have no choice. Duk, duk, and you become a monk, Buddhist monk, yeah? So that's what happened to me, I think, yeah. And I hope that conditioning is so strong I don't disrobe in this life, because that would be really bad, I think. So what happens then? Because you have all those views, yeah, you feel good about those views. If somebody asks me, how do you feel about Buddhism? I feel really good about Buddhism, yeah. If somebody asks me some kind of other question about what I think, there are some things that make me feel really good. Yeah, when I think back about my childhood in Norway, I think, wow, skiing, that's really nice, yeah? That's another view. Well, you guys may think skiing is crazy. Who wants to be out in the snow? Actually, being out in the snow is actually really, really cool and really nice. I can tell you that. And all of these things. So it feels good to us. That's why we have certain views. Because it feels good to us. We crave those views. Yeah, we actually desire to have those views. And that's why it is so difficult when somebody comes and challenges us and says, your view is bad. Skiing is for stupid people. It's just cold. Yeah, I want heat. I don't want the cold stuff. And so I say, what do you mean? You don't even know what you're talking about. I don't need to know about snow. It's obvious that it's cold. Everybody knows that. So you have the. So this is how you get these arguments. You crave those things, and because you crave them, you attach to them even more. Yeah, you pick them up even more, attach to them, and they become even more part of your personality as a consequence. So how you feel about things leads to what kind of views you have. Yeah, we feel about things in a certain way, and then we have views according to that. And that is kind of scary, isn't it? It means that far more important than our rational abilities is how we feel the world, is our emotional states. We are emotional beings, way, 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 not just women, we are all emotional beings, whether we are men or women, because that is what drives us. Feelings is what drives us. Feelings is what actually makes us do things. And once you start to recognize that, and you can recognize that because your views change through life and they alter, yeah? And then you start feeling differently about another view because your conditioning has changed. Like your political adherence, you often see that change in people over life. And once you start to see this, you start to feel, this is kind of scary. How can I trust my views? And you start to realize there is no inherent truth or falsehood in these views. They are just temporary things that exist because of how you feel about things, how you've been conditioned in the past. And that is why you have those views. And that is why I sometimes found myself, okay, I became a monk. Then what? Well, then I realized I really have to read these scriptures. I don't really know if I can trust this feeling. Okay, it feels right, but I really need to check it out. So then you start reading the suttas, yeah? And as you read them, that feeling I initially had of becoming a Buddhist monk starts to become much more solid. My first few years as a Buddhist monk, I was pretty shaky. Yeah, will I be a monk? Well, I said to Ajahn Ram, yeah, I can commit myself for 1 year max. Is that okay? Can I ordain? Ajahn Brahm said, no, okay, you can ordain. So I ordained. And I've been a monk ever since. Yes, it was probably a good decision. But it's always a bit shaky. But it becomes much, much stronger the more you start to understand these things. And that is how you kind of get this thing coming together. And then you start to build up this thing we call right view as a consequence. So how, this is how it all builds up. But you start to become very humble about your opinions, yeah? You start to become more humble about how you look at the world when you realize the shaky foundation is all built upon her. And I think this is one of the great things about the Buddha's teaching, that it actually teaches you that humility. And of course, if you have that humility, you also clash much less with people around you because you accept that your own views are temporary, perhaps, or they will evolve further down the line. They will change. Yeah? And then you have more sense of harmony together. Easy to let go of your own views. Easy to kind of go with the flow of things around you, rather than kind of hold on tenaciously. I am right, everyone else is wrong. Yeah? That is always a bad idea. Not a bad way of thinking about life. So what do we do? What we do is we come to the Buddha's teachings. When we come to the Buddha's teachings, we open the books, we listen to the talks, we start to see if it makes sense. If it makes sense to us, we start to go along. Gradually, as you go along in these teachings, your view gradually changes, yeah? But it's very natural, because you're allowing it to do according to your own pace. And as the view changes more and more and more, it gets more and more aligned according to reality. Yeah, until one day, your meditation is so profound, your insight is so deep, you see reality for actually what it is, and bam, you have what we call an awakening experience. And that's when you have this thing I said before, ditti patto. Ditti means view in Pali, the Pali language. Patto means attained. Attained to view. And now you have seen reality for what it actually is. Yeah? That's what happens at that point. And what a funny thing, what happens when you see reality for what it actually is, this is the first time you don't attach to the views anymore. No need to attach because you've seen reality, yeah? You know what it is. If somebody comes to me and says, you are not Brahmali, I say, okay, whatever, you know, I'm not going to get upset about that because it's just such an irrational and stupid statement to make. And the same thing, if you have seen reality for what it actually is, then you can't be challenged anymore. Nobody can really challenge you, so you just shrug your shoulders. You are independent of the world. And this is one of the qualities of a stream enter, someone who actually has seen truth for what it actually is. At that point, you're no longer attached to view. Before that, we have to attach to view to some extent. So be careful you don't mistake the goal and the path. During the path, some attachment is required. Only when you come to the goal do you let go of all the attachment and you have no attachment anymore. So what does that mean when you become like an awakened person? Does it mean that you have no views anymore because you have no attachment to these views? No, you still have views. Yeah, This idea that the end of the path is kind of giving up all views is actually a mistake. This is a mistake that is often done in Buddhism. What it means, when you come to the very end of the path, when you see things according to reality, when you have this incredible wow experience, remember, this is extraordinarily profound. It changes your outlook of the world absolutely, 180 degrees. You're looking in a different direction here. When that happens, you know exactly what is going on. The Buddha had right view. The Buddha had views. What he did not have was clinging to those views. And because he didn't cling to them, because he didn't attach to them, he didn't argue with other people. No need to argue anymore. That is what the Buddha is all about. The Buddha didn't have no views. What the Buddha didn't have was attachment to views. That is the distinction here. If the Buddha didn't have any views, we probably wouldn't have any suttas. We wouldn't have any discourses, yeah? The discourses are all about the Buddha presenting his views to the world. He says, this is the way the world is. It's impermanent, yeah? There are problems because of the impermanence. That problem is called suffering. There is no inherent core to the human being or any other kind of existence. That is what you see when you get to this point. And that is what is the final goal when you have the right view on the Buddha's path. So that is how to deal with views in your life. So just my recommendation, be humble about your views. I think it's a very powerful recommendation in life. I think people are often too sure of themselves. I think that's always a very negative thing here. And then allow yourself gradually, as you practice your spiritual life, as you learn about the Buddhist teachings, you will see a gradual change inside of you. Right view in Buddhism does not mean, yes, I have decided this is right, I believe in rebirth, yeah? I've got right view. That's not what right view is in Buddhism. It's part of it, but it's only a small part of it. Right view in Buddhism is a gradual development of your outlook, a gradual development of your values. Yeah, you start to see the world in a new way. Instead of wanting to become an investment banker with Goldman Sachs or something like that, you end up becoming a Buddhist monk instead. Yeah, this is how our values and our outlook change our ideas completely about what is important in life. Yeah, it's kind of being an investment banker with a Goldman Sachs, to me, sounds like the epitome of kind of the materialist world. Yeah, success, money, power, positions, all these kind of things. And Buddhist monk is almost the exact opposite of that. And this is how your views change, gradually. And then as you do that, your right view increases all the way through until one day you too, hopefully, can become someone with that right view of the Noble Ones and see reality for what it actually is. Okay, so that is a little talk for tonight about views. So there you are. Okay, so we've got the overseas questions, very good, but are there any questions from the hall here first of all before we take them from overseas? Anyone want to ask anything here? Yes, over there.
Have you had one of these awakening moments?
Oh, have I had awakening moments? Okay, that question is it's considered cheeky in Buddhism, right? And the reason, well, maybe if you don't know if you don't know what is what that question means, it's perfectly okay. But it's actually not, you can't say what you attain as a Buddhist monk. This is one of the rules of a Buddhist monk. So you can't say. So what you have to do, instead of asking that kind of question, you have to see whether someone has the qualities that conform with awakening. So you have to look very carefully. The onus is on you to observe, rather than on the speaker to say anything. Yeah. So you observe. And if you observe someone like Ajahn Brahm over a long period of time, see if he has those qualities, then you start to gain a bit of confidence that maybe he has that awakening experience. Anyway, if someone tells you, you will go afterwards, you will doubt it. Yeah, you'll think, yeah, sure, maybe he's just conceited, doesn't really know what he's talking about. There is no truth in that. You never find the truth by asking in that way. The truth you find by you looking and you investigating the issue. Yeah, that is the right way here. So I'm sorry about that. Anyone else would like to ask any questions? Anyone else? Absolutely happy. Whoa, it's really, really good. Anyone who's not a little bit unhappy would like to ask a question? Who has just a tiny bit of doubt about something? Absolute clarity for everyone. Okay, Stephen, you're always a reliable questioner. You have to wait for the microphone, Stephen. So, yeah.
Ajahn, you see quite a lot of writings, and you've done some brilliant writings on dependent origination, but you don't hear so much about dependent liberation.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a reason for that?
I talk about dependent liberation.
I know you do, but I'm saying most people might hear about dependent origination, but there aren't that many writings about dependent liberation.
Yeah.
So could you just say more about dependent liberation?
I'll tell you a secret. You want to hear a secret? Maybe we should close the doors, first of all, before we tell the secret. So the secret... Ajahn Brahm told me that he had one of his most amazing experiences as a Buddhist monk while contemplating dependent liberation. Yeah, so I think it's one of those things that actually is very worthwhile contemplating here. But dependent liberation, just for those of you who don't know what it is, it shows you the sequence of factors from the beginning all the way to the attainment of liberation here. And it starts off, usually, you know what it starts off with? It starts off with morality. Yeah, that's what it starts off with. If you are a moral person, if you live your life well, if you think kindly of other people, if you practice your moral life thoroughly well, all the way to the core, both doing the good things, also avoiding the bad things, that is the foundation upon which all awakening and all liberation actually is based. And that is really, I think, it's a very beautiful teaching, and it basically goes through those factors, shows you the joy and happiness that comes from all of this, and then eventually coming to samadhi, seeing things according to reality, and then liberation. If you're interested in reading about it, I gave a talk that was transcribed a while ago, and I don't know if you're referring to that, Stephen, but in that talk is available on the internet. So if you look up Ajahn Brahmali, Dependent Liberation, you can probably find it on the internet. If not, come and ask me. I'll be very happy. I'll feel very proud if you come and ask me for my book, yeah? So you can you can come and ask me about my book, yeah? Anyone else like to ask anything here? Everyone's happy here? Yeah? Everyone's happy. Okay, good. So let's see what we have from overseas. Okay, is the main aim of the Eightfold Path, apart from awakening, to achieve samadhi and jhana factors? Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Because the Eightfold Path, if you know your Eightfold Path, it starts with right view, but it ends with samadhi. Yeah, it ends with jhana. So that is, if you like, the purpose. It's a gradual movement from right view all the way up to jhana. And the reason why the jhanas or the samadhi is the last factor of the Eightfold Path is because from that, awakening tends to happen by itself. Once you have jhana, you're so close to awakening that it kind of happens. All you have to do is turn your mind in the right direction, and awakening tends to happen as a consequence. So get your samadhi really solid, and then you are in business. Yeah. So jhana is like one of the crucial factors as you go through this process. Question number two. The problem with views is that every view has an element of truth. Is Buddhism a series of compromises? No, it is not. You are right that perhaps not every view, but many views have an element of truth to them. So what you do, you have to choose those things that really matter, yeah? And you put away all those views that are irrelevant. Views about the world, I mean, who cares which sporting team is the best one, yeah? It's kind of irrelevant. Views about politics, well, after a while you get fed up arguing about politics. So you focus on those views that really matter. What are those views? Those views, they are that things are impermanent, yeah? And this doesn't just have an element of truth to it. The more you understand the Buddhist teachings, you understand this is like a bedrock truth upon which all existence is affected by this particular truth. So there are certain truths that are have a more complete element of truth to them than others that actually are real truths. So you have to figure out what those are and focus on those. Yeah, kindness leads to happiness is another one of those obvious truths. And I would like you to kind of look at that inside of yourself and see, when you're kind, how do you feel about yourself? I know how I feel about myself when I try to be kind. Yeah, I will try to be kind to my fellow Venerable Kassapa this weekend and see what happens. He's very easy to be kind to because he's such a friendly person, but I will still try that. And try to be kind. And every time you're kind to somebody, you tend to feel good about yourself. Notice that, because that is very much what the path is about. So the way to find that truth which matters is to read the suttas, understand the word of the Buddha. That is where that foundational truth comes from, and how you start to align your own view with the actual reality as it actually is. That's why the Buddha, again, is the eye of the world, yeah? And he passes that information on to us. So. Question number three. What is the best way to get right view when you are in acute situation of anger, sadness, or pain? How do you find distance and peace then? What is the right view in that moment? Okay, so when you have very powerful emotions like this, you have to be very careful. So the right view in those situations is to know, especially when you are angry, but sadness also. Pain is a little bit different because pain is not really a defilement of the mind. Sadness is a little bit of a defilement because it is a delusion. Yeah, it is not really required. It's not seeing things according to reality. The Buddha doesn't get sad, for example. So when you have defilements in the mind, you get very angry, or you're very, very sad to the point of being depressed or whatever, remember that you cannot trust your outlook at that time, especially when you're angry. Angry is one of the worst ones. Once you remember you can't trust your outlook, in other words, you have a distortion of view, then you are very careful what you say, very careful what you do, even careful what you think while you're angry. Maybe you kind of leave the building, yeah, you go outside, walk around really fast, because when you're angry you can walk really fast, yeah? Walk really, really fast around the block until you're really exhausted and then kind of the anger comes down and then you kind of go back again, in again, and you kind of say hello to your husband or wife and kids or whatever it is afterwards when you kind of cool down. Use wise strategies not to allow that anger to spill out of you. Understand that this is the wrong time to do things. That is the right view in those situations. Understand your own delusion. Even if you can't see it, trust that the Buddha knew what he was talking about. He says you are deluded in these instances. Okay, that is all for tonight. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Namasami Supatipatthana.